You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Chris Farrell from Marketplace is back with us. He says 2017 is a great year to start a second act, changing careers, starting a new retirement job path, and other big economic changes.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news with stories from next week's primary election, an announcement that shakes up the U.S. Senate race in 2018, and a big demonstration on immigration issues in Milwaukee and other cities.
Robert Mentzer joins us now. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, Rob, it is great to be back.
Let's start with the Day Without Immigrants protest on Monday. That was a statewide one. There was a national protest, a similar protest on Thursday. What happened here in Wisconsin earlier in the week?
Yes, so the largest protest in Wisconsin happened in Milwaukee on Monday. They called this was called the Day Without Latinos, right. Immigrants, and Refugees. So this was organized by the immigrants' rights group Voces de la Frontera and some other groups. And this was a large event. There were thousands of people who showed up for this. There were buses of activists from Green Bay and Appleton, from Racine, Wisconsin Dells. And so, you know, this event itself is not brand new. A Day Without Immigrants as a demonstration has happened before, but I think that it has some resonance in the Trump era, especially as this week we saw what looks like an increase in raids and arrests by the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Service. So there was a large turnout, a lot of interest in this, and they certainly made their voices heard.
And this wasn't just in Milwaukee, though.
Well, the largest protests happened in Milwaukee. They marched down through the past the courthouse. They aimed some protests at Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark, who has had a lot of things to say on the topic. But throughout the state, there were you know, some participation in the Day Without Immigrants. Sort of the national event happened on Thursday. You know, we had even here in central Wisconsin, we had a reporter spoke with folks in the small town called Abbotsford, which has had an influx of Latino immigration in the past decade or so. So the Wausau Daily Herald reported that that some businesses closed even in Little Abbotsford, right? And one of the major employers there, this was interesting, Abbeyland Foods actually slowed production and partly shut down production on Monday because there were so many workers at that plant that wanted to travel to Milwaukee for that protest.
And immigration, your papers have reported, a big issue, and it's not always on the radar, in smaller towns and in rural Wisconsin.
This is true, and it's especially it's hard as, you know, if immigrants come from all over the place, and there's reporting on somebody who's you know Syrian refugees are scattered throughout Wisconsin in small numbers. A large number of immigrants are Latino, and in many cases we see in central Wisconsin, for instance, they often are employed in the agricultural sector, living in rural areas, and so there may not be as much attention, publicity. They may not be as visible in some cases, and so this was this demonstration and this protest was designed to counteract that.
Talking to Rob Mentzer from the USA Today Network Wisconsin, rounding up some of the top stories in Wisconsin news. Couple pieces of election news here. One election just a few days away, one a bunch of months away. Let's start with the one coming up. Department of Public Instruction Superintendent, top job in Wisconsin schools. Primary, three candidates. Primary's coming up Tuesday. The two challengers to incumbent Tony Evers, the story goes, met in December. They were brought together by business people. They agree so far. What are we hearing now? Their stories diverge.
I love this story. Don't you love this story,
it's
Rob?
It's an unusual story.
I cannot help it. I am fascinated by this. So this was first reported by Molly Beck of the Wisconsin State Journal. I know she spoke about this on Central Time. So this meeting existed, right? So the thing to understand is that the incumbent in this race for state superintendent is Tony Evers, and it is a nonpartisan post. But Tony Evers is more aligned with the Democratic Party in his sort of approach to education issues. The two challengers, Lowell Holtz and John Humphreys, It is fair to say that they are more aligned with the Republican Party in their approach to education. So the idea, I think, was that some Republican businessmen saw it as more advantageous that they sort of train their fire on Tony Evers and suggested that they get together and try to work out how they might cooperate. But what's bananas is there's this document that were released, actually two versions of a similar document, showing that sketching out a potential deal if one of them were to drop out or perhaps after the primary for going forward, that guarantees a $150,000 a year government job to the other for 3 years, full benefits with a driver, and then also this is another wrinkle is apparently in this document included the idea that whoever dropped out would somehow be able to take over large urban school districts in the state, which is really not how it works, but is in this document that was released.
And it's been pointed out that $150,000 is more than the superintendent himself, I guess it's all guys, himself would make after the election.
Yeah, so it doesn't, I mean, it's just bizarre. The document, so to quote it, the document said that that maybe this is just an idea that was thrown around, according to Holtz, but it said that this other person would have, quote, complete authority over Milwaukee, Racine, Kenosha, and Madison that would include the authority to, quote, change boards when I deem it necessary and to break apart districts. This, to me, this suggests that whoever wrote this document does not understand how the state's education system
right.
works.
That would take probably a constitutional change to give the superintendent's department that power.
The school boards are elected. You can't, I mean, I don't necessarily fault the average Wisconsinite for not quite understanding exactly what it is the state superintendent does or has authority over. But if you're running for the office, I feel like you would kind of look into it, wouldn't you?
So this is conventionally a low turnout rate. These quote-unquote nonpartisan primaries. I throw air quotes around it because they usually end up being pretty partisan. Is this going to generate interest, do you think, and get people out voting?
It's generated interest for me. This is an odd story and coming right immediately before this election. I think for sure it does have the effect of raising the profile of this race. On the other hand, somebody today is having a press release calling this a three-ring circus, and that's not far wrong. I think it's maybe all publicity is good publicity, but I feel like this is not the sort of attention that these guys might have wished to have.
All right, a higher profile race, but it's a ways off, the race for the U.S. Senate seat next year. And maybe people think, oh, that's too early to think about elections. I'll say from my email inbox, some of the political parties are daily thinking about this election already. Congressman Sean Duffy, a lot of people had said he would run as the Republican against incumbent Senator Democrat Tammy Baldwin. He says, nope. What do we know about his decision?
Yeah, people do complain about, we just had an election and we're already talking about the next one. And I know this is a minority view, but I've got to tell you, I find the sort of this early maneuvering and political positioning in the sort of year before the election year way more interesting than anything that happened.
No, me too. I'm just kidding.
it's interesting that, so in this case, Republican Sean Duffy, he represents the 7th Congressional District in Wausau and sort of the northwest quadrant of the state. He was thought to have been a potential front runner to challenge Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin. He goes on TV a lot. He raises a lot of money. He has won his congressional races by huge margins. So he was kind of a favorite. And as you can imagine, Wisconsin Republicans would really like to beat Tammy Baldwin in that Senate race. So Duffy says he is out. He cited his family as a reason that he's not running. He has 8 children, some quite young children. But this is politics, and so it's hard not to read it as at least some sort of a guess or a way of reading tea leaves that that maybe his calculation is that 2018 might be a tough year for Republicans.
So he's not in. Who are we looking at? A lot of people, I think, were waiting to see if Duffy was going to do it. He's not. So does that open the door to a lot of entries?
Yeah, it's very possible that there could be a big old primary. So there is Sheriff David Clark, the rather Trumpian figure who has been a darling of some out-of-state conservative activists. I have no idea if that goes anywhere or not. Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald has expressed interest in running. And there are some other names kicking around, state legislators, Leah Vukmir, Dale Koyenga, and the real estate developer and rich guy Eric Hovde, who ran in 2012 but lost the Republican primary that year. So, I mean, it could end up being a big field.
We'll have a lot to watch for. Rob, thanks, as always, for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Robert Mentzer, storytelling editor for USA Today Network Wisconsin. He joins us each week at this time for our Wisconsin News Roundup.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Farad. Coming up, we'll look at the heated news conference with President Trump yesterday and talk about his relationship with the press.
First, if you're looking to start a new chapter in your career, changing jobs, starting a business, getting into a new line of work, perhaps after retiring from your old occupation, our guest has some good news. He says 2017 is looking like a great year to make a change.
Chris Farrell joins us now. He's senior economics contributor at Marketplace. He's the author of Unretirement: How Baby Boomers Are Changing the Way We Think About Work, Community, and the Good Life. His piece on the website Next Avenue is linked on our Central Time Facebook page. Chris, welcome back to the show.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
Why is 2017 looking like a good year for a new chapter in our careers?
So, you know, one definition of a good economy is when firms, organizations are looking for workers. A bad economy is when workers are looking for firms to get hired. And right now, with the unemployment rate at 4.8% and companies really complaining about they can't find the qualified workers they need, they can't find the skilled workers they need, the National Federation of Independent Business in its survey, it had a 29% of small businesses surveyed, so they can't find the workers they need. And so in that kind of environment, and I don't want to exaggerate how strong this job market is, but it is strong and it's getting stronger. What we've had, 76 straight months of monthly employment gains in that kind of environment? Hey, you've been thinking about making a change. What are you waiting for?
So employees are in a better position relative to employers than they had been, certainly 8 years ago.
Absolutely. I mean, you just have a lot more leverage and you have a lot more options. And frankly, I also think, you know, there's always the risk that you make a shift, you make a change, transitions are difficult. It doesn't really quite work out the way you thought it would. In a stronger economic environment with a healthy job market, you know, the downside risk of something going bad or you having to rethink things or shift to another job, it's just a lot less.
Well, I want to look at some different particular situations people might find themselves in. And let's start with maybe the retiree. They're looking for a post-retirement job either because they need the extra income or they want to do something. They want to keep working, but maybe in a different line of work. What kind of things can they think about?
Okay, so one of the things that this retiree needs to realize is you're not going to get a job with your resume. You're not going to get a job going through the human resources department. Some people will, but most people get their jobs through their network, you know, their former colleagues, their acquaintances, their neighbors. What is that? What's the expression? The third degree of separation. Because these people don't care about your age. They know who you are. They know your skills. And, you know, research overall shows that more than half of all jobs come through your network anyway. So tap into your network. And part of it is tapping your network for this very practical reason, and that's probably where you're going to find out where you're going to get your next job. But also tap into your network to say, hey, what do you think I would be good at doing? You know, I've been doing this for the past 10, 15 years. It's a good job, but I want to have something that I'm a little more excited about, a little more jazzed about. So also use your network to get you thinking about what might be some possibilities.
This is advice probably for anybody, not just that retiree. But let me ask you, Chris, what about somebody like me who is bad at networking, hates networking? how would somebody, if my bosses are listening, I'm not looking, don't worry. How about somebody like me, bad at networking, who does want to make that change for whatever it's worth? How do you start on something like that?
So, you know, you sort of, first of all, you just drop the word networking.
Uh-huh.
And then you start thinking about, you know, I've stayed in loose touch with a couple of friends from college and, you know, people who knew me back in college. And I'm going to get back in touch with them. And we kind of have known each other, but I haven't been that close. And sort of say, hey, you know, what did I say I wanted to do back then? I can't quite remember. And they're going to say, well, you thought you wanted to do X, Y, or Z. So you're not, it's a way of networking, but it's a slightly different way of networking. Tap into your friends. Tap into your family. And if you're uncomfortable meeting with strangers, and by the way, when I say networking, I'm not talking about going to one of these networking events where you get handed a cocktail and you put some sort of badge on and you say, hi, I'm Chris. I'm talking about, you know, your former college roommates, your you know, some colleagues that you worked with, some people that you've stayed in contact over the years. Maybe there's somebody, if you're involved in some nonprofit organization, some volunteering work, and then just take people out that you like, that you think do something interesting and say, hey, can I have a cup of coffee with you? Let me buy you a cup of coffee. I just want to say, how did you get to where you are? And, you know, I'm just curious. And the thing is, you may not like networking, but I can guarantee you, because of your job, you're curious and you want to learn things. And so if you think about, I'm going to go out there and learn about what other people are doing, you may very well stumble on what you want to do.
If there's coffee and cocktails, I guess it can't be all bad. We're talking to Chris Farrell.
That's exactly. I mean, you know, what else is there to life?
We've got Chris Farrell with us from Marketplace. He says 2017, good year for a change, a second act maybe in your career, a new line of work, a post-retirement job, or... Chris, self-employment. This is a time to start considering that. How does somebody get started thinking about taking that plunge, maybe from a secure job that they don't love into a risky job of being an entrepreneur or a consultant or something like that?
Right. So one of the most stunning figures, and of course, I love numbers. I live in a world of numbers, but I just give you one number. A quarter of all new businesses started last year was by the 55 to 64-year-old age group.
Wow.
And that's up from about 15% in 1997. Now, when I say go out and start your own business or self-employment, I'm not talking about draining that 401k and taking some huge risk. Instead, you mentioned someone's got a secure job. So do you have a side gig, or is there some sort of side gig you've been thinking about? You know, try some side gigs, do a little bit of experimentation, get together with some friends. You have a, you know, you have sort of an ability to edit, and there's a lot of podcasting going on around. Maybe someone needs some freelance podcasting and you can do a little bit of work on the side. And, you know, it's not a full-time job. It's kind of interesting. These are interesting people, but you start realizing, hey, you know, one job is leading to another, and I'm beginning to see how this feeds out. Maybe I might want to go ahead and do this. Or you're doing some tutoring on the side. You're doing some teaching. I mean, there's all kinds of ways, but I would start with the notion of a side gig. I start with the notion that you do not want to spend very much. And if you look at the average self-employment number, it's the business costs $5,000 or less to get started. So you're not going to spend big. You're going to be cautious. You're going to experiment, and you're going to start with a side gig.
Let's talk about someone out there we've talked about a lot on the show and through the election. Maybe that person, 40 to 60, they've had, high school-ish education. They've had maybe the factory job. A factory's automated or it's moved, no job anymore. Service sector jobs, lower paid ones, maybe available, maybe not. What kind of things can they do to try to get started of that second act of necessity, in this case, not of choice?
Of necessity. And of course, as you always know, you know, when you make these pronouncements, I'm sitting in a radio studio. Oh, you can go do this. You can go do that. And we know transitions are hard and it's not easy. But I've interviewed a number of, for example, in Cleveland, interviewed an iron worker, and he didn't like school. He hated school. He couldn't wait. He graduated from high school, never went to community college, never went to college. He was an iron worker for 30 years. And now he's retired, needs some income, and he's working in an apprenticeship program in a technical high school. And he's really the assistant. He's not even the head teacher. And he says, you know what really stuns me? Is I love these kids. I love this.
Love school.
I hated school, but I'm really enjoying this. So it's kind of like, you know, broadening your horizon. But for a lot of people, it's going to be getting some kind of certificate, some kind of skill, perhaps at the community college that you can then take into another sector of the economy.
Hey, Chris, one way or another, I mean, the old model of the career, you sign on with a company, maybe work your way up for a while, retire, office party at the end of the gig. That's not it anymore. We're going through multiple employers, maybe multiple careers in a lifetime.
That's right. So I think what you, particularly if you're a younger person listening to this, you know, start thinking about that model of the career. You're absolutely right. That no longer works. So start thinking about your career as a lifestyle. And building a lifestyle, and then what skills, what learning do you need? And thinking about, you know, sometimes you're going to be with an employer and you're going to learn a lot. Because, you know, one of the advantages of working with a big employer is they'll spend a lot of money on you training. One of the advantages of working for a small business is you get a lot of responsibility because everyone has to kind of do everything. One advantage of being on your own is your own boss. And where the world has changed is those three options are available to you. And so you're planning is about building a lifestyle, then build your finances around that lifestyle, as opposed to say, for example, I'm gonna work really hard and I'm gonna save all my money because then when I'm 60, the world's gonna be a wonderful place because I'm gonna go off and for the rest of my life be in leisure, and you find out that's actually not a good world.
And Chris, in some ways, I mean, that sounds scary and unpredictable. In another way, it maybe takes the pressure off of if that first job you take or your college major or something turns out not to be the right one, there is time for a second and third and fourth chapter.
You know, one of the things I've really talked to a lot of young people, and they're graduating from college, and there's just so much pressure for them to figure out their career, to figure out what it is they're going to be doing. And just what you're saying, you know, look, you have a job. You go to another job, you do a little bit of experimentation. And I think a lot of us, when we look back, we had wonderful moments in our careers, and then they pass. And then you have some difficult times, and then you find something else. So it really is about being more in control. And if you're learning, and if you're curious, and you accept the fact that you're going to be doing a variety of things, I think that gives you a certain power. You can't control the stock market. Can't control what's going to happen to the economy. But if you're willing to have an entrepreneurial mindset, not to be necessarily be an entrepreneur, but an entrepreneurial mindset, that will hold you in good stead when you're young in your career and when you are in the twilight of your career.
We'll leave it there. Chris, always good to talk to you.
Thanks a lot.
That's Chris Farrell, senior economics contributor at Marketplace, author of the book Unretirement. His piece on second act careers in 2017 is linked over at the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up, we take a closer look at what led to the tense exchange between President Trump and reporters at a lively press conference yesterday. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. Coming up after 7 on Ken Rudin's Political Junkie, national security blunders then and now. Ken looks at Michael Flynn's resignation as the short-lived national security advisor, and then he revisits 2003 when Secretary of State Colin Powell addressed the UN Security Council on the now discredited notion of Saddam Hussein having weapons of mass destruction. That's after 7 on the Ideas Network.
First, President Trump's statements at a news conference yesterday have been getting a lot of attention. The conference is notable not just because of the president's answers to political questions, but because of his interactions with the press.
One of the unusual parts of the news conference was when Trump was asked by Jake Turks, an Orthodox Jewish reporter, about anti-Semitism in the U.S. Turks prefaced his question saying that he did not believe that Trump and his staff were anti-Semitic. His question was about what the government would do about the surge of threats on Jewish centers. Take a listen.
What we are concerned about, and what we haven't really heard being addressed, is an uptick in anti-Semitism and how the government is planning to take care of it. There's been a report out that 48 bomb threats have been made against Jewish centers all across the country in the last couple of weeks. There are people who are committing anti-Semitic acts or threatening to...
You see, he said he was going to ask a very simple, easy question. And it's not. It's not. Not a simple question. Not a fair question. Okay, sit down. I understand the rest of your question. So here's the story, folks. Number one, I am the least anti-Semitic person that you've ever seen in your entire life. Number two, racism, the least racist person. In fact, we did very well relative to other people running as a Republican. Quiet, quiet, quiet. See, he lied about he was going to get up and ask a very straight, simple question. So, you know, it's welcome to the world of the media.
President Trump went on to say that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had vouched for him as someone who is not an anti-Semite. He did not talk about the surge of threats against Jewish centers in the United States.
There were plenty of other strongly worded remarks directed at the press. Lucas Graves joins us now. He's an assistant professor at UW-Madison's School of Journalism and Mass Communication. He's also author of the book Deciding What's True, The Rise of Political Fact-Checking in American Journalism. Lucas, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. That's great to be here.
This news conference started with President Trump announcing his nominee for Secretary of the Department of Labor, Alexander Acosta. But that was a fleeting moment. His thoughts quickly spiraled off in other directions. What struck you about both the tone and the content?
I mean, I think there's no avoiding the conclusion that, you know, Donald Trump speaks in a way that we're not used to hearing presidents speak. He was an unusual campaigner, and his unusual speaking style and his way of relating to the press, you know, has continued since he stepped into the Oval Office. So I think a few features that sort of jump out are that he's unusually combative. I mean, of course, presidents have a long history of having difficult relationships with the press, but Donald Trump, you know, makes attacking the media, even during a press conference, an almost routine feature of his comments, and he, you know, slings some pretty nasty insults at them. And I think it's fair to say that he's also unusually defensive. So he'll respond to perceived criticisms or to attacks in a way that presidents typically haven't. And I think it's a fascinating moment because you can sort of see, you know, in the reactions to this press conference, you can sort of see journalists and the rest of sort of establishment Washington trying to figure out what this means and, you know, whether this is sort of a new normal or whether, you know, it's a sign that the wheels are sort of rapidly coming off. I mean, nobody can quite figure out how to process Donald Trump's very different presidential style.
NBC reporter Peter Alexander challenged the president for misrepresenting the size of the electoral win. President Trump said he had the, quote, biggest electoral college win since Ronald Reagan. Let's take a listen.
You said today that you had the biggest electoral margin since Ronald Reagan with 304 or 306 electoral votes. In fact, President Obama got 365.
Well, I'm talking about Republican.
President Obama, 332, and George H.W. Bush, 426 when he won as president. So why should Americans trust?
Well, no, I was told, I was given that information. I don't know. I was just given. We had a very, very big margin.
I guess my question is, why should Americans trust you when you accuse the information they receive of being fake when you're providing information?
Well, I don't know. I was given that information. I've seen that information around. But it was a very substantial victory. Do you agree with that?
You're the president.
What do you make of this exchange and what it says about fact-checking?
That was a really extraordinary moment, I thought. I mean, it speaks on the one hand to the fact that Donald Trump has really helped to institutionalize fact-checking as a now permanent feature of the sort of journalistic landscape. I mean, it has been in the past mainly practiced during campaigns, but, you know, in the wake of this press conference, you saw, you know, almost every major news outlet offers some kind of fact check. And in that clip, we heard a reporter directly challenging the president's facts. I mean, he has this very well-established reputation for mistakes and exaggerations and for being, you know, pretty loose with the truth. At the same time, though, it also highlights what I think is the real concern that I have, and that I think a lot of observers have, about what might be changing in political discourse right now. And that's, you know, the way that Donald Trump is really has sort of a disregard for the facts. Like, it's not so much that he, makes more checkable statements than other politicians, but also that he just doesn't seem that concerned about the idea that, you know, some statements are truer than others, or that you should offer evidence for your assertions. And you saw that in the way that he casually, you know, said, well, somebody gave me that information. And that's a real challenge to sort of the established ways of talking at that level of politics. And I think it's sort of a worrying trend.
We're talking with Lucas Graves. He's an assistant professor at UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Talking about yesterday's news conference, President Trump spent 77 minutes addressing the press corps. Russia came up again and again, and the National Security Advisor was dismissed this week, which raised even more questions about the Trump administration's ties with Russia. President Trump said, Russia is a ruse. I have nothing to do with Russia. And he ultimately said that he wasn't aware of anyone on his campaign having contact with Russian officials. Fact checkers jumped all over this. What do you make of how he went, how he spoke about Russia and the response by journalists?
I mean, I think one of the reasons that we saw such an aggressive response to that is that what's come out is that the White House knew long before dismissing the National Security Advisor, they knew that he, at the very least, that he had misrepresented both the fact and the nature of his conversations to the vice president and, you know, perhaps to others in the White House. And so their willingness, you know, the fact that he wasn't dismissed until this became a big story. And so apparently the White House wasn't very concerned about it initially, I think has a lot of reporters wondering. And there's also the very sort of perplexing statement Trump offered, which was that, you know, the leaks are real, but the news is fake. And that sort of, you know, that didn't make sense to a lot of journalists because they think, well, if the leaks are real, then there's a real story here and the news isn't fake. But Donald Trump has been really... you know, really, really consistent in dismissing stories that he doesn't like as fake news. It shows how quickly that term has been sort of turned on its head. And it's now used, you know, to discredit the idea that we can trust any mainstream journalism at all. And I think that, you know, that advances the cause of politicians who don't want to be held accountable for the things that they say.
And the first question went to Mara Liasson, NPR's White House correspondent. She asked a five-word question, did you fire Mike Flynn? And it got me thinking about how the press corps is querying this president. I've often heard journalists asking these long-winded questions, multifaceted questions, two or three packed into the same sentence. But here she was asking five words. How have journalists changed their approach and how they question Mr. Trump?
That's a really interesting question. I mean, you know, we've already heard some rumors. They're, you know, unverified, I think, at this point, but some rumors that intelligence officials are changing the ways that they present, you know, briefings and intelligence data to suit the president's preferred sort of, you know, information processing style. And it may very well be that journalists are changing the ways that they present, that they make questions to respond to his, you know, to adapt to his unusual approach. It certainly wouldn't be surprising. We've seen, you know, a long history of changes in the ways that press conferences were conducted. They were, you know, initially off the record. So FDR's press conferences were off the record, for instance. You know, television was introduced under under Eisenhower, but press conferences weren't live until the Kennedy administration. That really changed the dynamics and made them, you know, sort of an opportunity to perform for the audience, you know, for both the press and the president, rather than just to get information from the president. But the most dramatic change that we've seen, and there's a lot of research about this, is that since the 50s and especially after 1968, journalists have become much more aggressive and much more sort of inquisitorial in the ways that they present their questions. And that's because, you know, aggressive watchdog journalism, investigative journalism became much more valued in the wake of Vietnam and Watergate. So it could be that we're again, you know, we're seeing journalists sort of change their approach to adapt to this new leadership?
We're talking to Lucas Graves, assistant professor at UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication, about President Trump's heated exchange with journalists at yesterday's news conference.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What did you think of that news conference yesterday? Do you think that the president or members of the press were out of line on either side for their part? What do you make of the relationship between the Washington reporters and the president? What do you want to see from the media as they cover the president and ask him questions in these conferences? Call in now, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue this conversation here on Central Time after this short break.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're continuing the conversation with Lucas Graves, assistant professor at UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication.
We're talking about yesterday's presidential press conference, 77 minutes, a very different style, a lot of back and forth between the president and the press. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Did you watch? What did you think? 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Talk show host Rush Limbaugh had a different perspective on this press conference. He called it masterful for being unscripted and therefore closer to the truth. Is that how some of President Trump's supporters and people who are tired of certain conventions in Washington are going to see these press conferences?
I think that's likely. And the fact that our media environment is more it was more fractured today and more sort of polarized and politicized today than it, you know, than it was 20 years ago, I think helps to explain Trump's strategy in this press conference, which was very, I think, very clearly and very explicitly directed at, you know, aimed at the public and aimed at his base. He almost said as much, you know, in his opening remarks.
And was Mr. Trump's behavior staying true to his anti-establishment message?
Well, I think that's hard to say. That's in the eye of the beholder. I think certainly he's very clearly painting a narrative in which he, you know, continuing the narrative in which he came to Washington to shake things up. In his opening remarks, he, you know, took dead aim at the press in a really unusually aggressive way and accused them of misreporting, you know, all of the sort of successes that his White House had achieved. And so clearly there's a perception that, you know, it's still advantageous to the White House to argue that they're there fighting against the, you know, this establishment press.
Let's take a call now with Damien from Green Bay. Hi, Damien.
Yes, hello.
What would you like to add about the press conference?
Well, I think the reporter from CNN needs to be commended for calling President Trump on his blatant lie concerning Electoral College votes. And going forward into the Trump presidency, I think this is exactly what the news media needs to do and hold his feet to the fire immediately when he delivers just complete fallacies to the public.
Lucas?
You know, I couldn't agree more. I mean, one of the most exciting developments, I think, in journalism in the last decade or so is that reporters are increasingly willing to hold politicians accountable for false statements on both sides of the aisle. One thing to keep in mind, though, is that that's not going to do much. It's probably not going to do much for the press's popularity, which, you know, is sort of at abysmal lows. And there's a lot of evidence that more aggressive reporting, more fact checking, actually alienates a lot of the public, and will make people think that journalists are biased.
Well, Damien, thanks so much for your call. Let's now go to Paul in Oshkosh. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Something that's interesting to me is that it seems like over the last 15 to 20 years that the citizens like myself, Americans, become less and less trusting of the media. It seems the media has been more and more biased and not transparent in reporting. And, you know, now that's just opened the door for someone like Donald Trump to come in here and pull the shenanigans he's pulling and getting away with it.
Lucas?
I think that's really true. I mean, one of the great ironies of the last 30 years is that reporting has gotten better and better, but people's perceptions of the media have gotten worse and worse.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us, Lucas.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
That was Lucas Graves. He's an assistant professor at UW-Madison's School of Journalism and Mass Communication. He's also author of the book Deciding What's True, The Rise of Political Fact-Checking in American Journalism. He joined us to talk about reactions to President Trump's press conference yesterday.
State School Superintendent Tony Evers is thought of as one of the last left-leaning statewide office holders in Wisconsin. Kyla Calvert-Mason reports that he faces two challengers in Tuesday's nonpartisan primary with the backing of state Republicans and business leaders.
John Humphreys and Lowell Holtz each tout their experiences working in rural, urban, and suburban school districts as they campaign to be Wisconsin's next school superintendent. And each says his leadership would be a more conservative alternative to two-term incumbent Tony Evers. Humphreys has rolled out ideas in press conferences across the state that he says appeal to a bipartisan coalition of supporters.
The first part's about accountability. The second part is about being careful with our resources. And then the third part, empowering local parents and educators.
Under that umbrella, Humphreys is proposing new school report cards, creating a state board of education, and letting parents at the state's lowest performing, high poverty public schools choose new leadership teams. The ideas have gotten him financial backing from the Metro Milwaukee Association of Commerce. The second challenger, Holtz, argues he's the only true conservative in the race and has gotten financial support from county Republican and Tea Party groups.
One of my first items on the platform is restoring safety and discipline to all schools. I really believe in local control. And then last but not least, I think it's really important that we empower teachers to do what they do best, which is teach.
Holtz favors scrapping the state's teacher evaluation system and a database to track student progress from preschool to high school. But the two are hardly teaming up against incumbent Evers. This week, Humphreys accused Holtz of proposing one guarantee the other a job in exchange for dropping out of the race. Holtz countered the two met only to discuss possible cooperation at the behest of unnamed state business leaders. There are places, though, where their views overlap. Both support expanding private school vouchers and letting local leaders decide what students should be learning. Humphreys says Evers unilaterally tied Wisconsin to using the Common Core standards, guidelines for learning in each grade adopted by more than 40 states.
He made the decision to adopt the Common Core for the entire state. And even the legislature at one point wanted to intervene and create a board to oversee that implementation.
And each points to Wisconsin's achievement gap between black and white students, the largest in the nation, as another reason to replace Evers. Holtz says closing that gap takes setting high standards and supporting all students.
And I don't use this term lightly. The Department of Public Instruction has turned their back on our kids of color, and that's the very epitome of institutionalized racism.
Evers dismisses their critiques. He says each school district adopted the Common Core and that student achievement has made progress since he entered office in 2009.
We've increased expectations for kids at the and at the same time been able to keep our achievement level and slowly increasing. I certainly would like to have it increase more.
In his next term, Evers says he'd push for more state funding for schools, support for students' mental health, and a prescription for boosting student performance that moves outside school walls.
What, as a state, we have to do is be partners with struggling school districts, engage the community, but also recognize that this is more than a school issue. This is a community issue, and this is a state issue. Whether it's around race or poverty, we have to address a lot of those things simultaneously.
Evers' financial backers include the state's teacher and administrators' unions, but he doesn't buy that voters think of schools in partisan terms. He says Governor Scott Walker's proposed budget adopts many of Evers' own ideas, and bipartisan support swept him into office in the last two races.
You can't win 69 out of 72 counties without having some Republicans voting for you.
The top two vote-getters in Tuesday's primary will face off in the general election on April 4th. Kyla Calvert-Mason, Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.